Like all stories, Anansi the God Spider knew that this one was complicated. It was the result of a long series of events that began way before the parents of the men and the women in the field had even been ideas in the minds of their ancestors. It was an original sin that was as old as the universe. You see, Anansi knew that the war raging in the mines, in the fields, and in the mountains was only half the story. That the real war had been lost long ago. Not with machetes, gunpowder, or spilled blood, but through subtle failures of human nature. He had collected these stories too, hungry for them, even as he could see the dark and bloody path down which they would lead. From the first murder, brother killing brother with a rock out of jealousy for a father's love, to the king who ordered a general to die so he could take the man's wife for himself. Then there was the queen bathing in the blood of her subjects out of a desperate attempt to cling to fickle youth, and the endless wars and the spoils of those wars. Anansi knew that you could draw a straight line from these things to the fields. So many fields of cotton, of sugarcane, fields with countless bodies, each carrying their own stories. But Anansi knew that before these bodies had been in the fields, they had been back in that place, living their lives, unknowingly moving towards the tragedy of the current moment. Hello again and welcome back. As always, I am History, and we are in the middle of what may be thought of as Kamau's story. Please, do not begin in the middle. Instead, begin at chapter 1, and I promise the story will be that more satisfying. But really, it's not just Kamau's story. It is the story of all of you. The story of your world and the secrets that it holds. Understood by looking at some fantastical and remarkable events. Today, we will be exploring a figure whose mark on history rivals even that of Kamau the Obaifo. We will be uncovering ancient, previously hidden texts from which we can piece together an outline of the terrifying and notorious Hunter. Little information is available about Hunter, but the consummate historical researcher can piece together details about his long life and how he came to be on that island in the employ of the crown, hunting the Obaifo. Scholars digging in some remote corner of that vast and still mostly stubbornly untamed continent uncovered writings in the forgotten language of a people that no longer exist. It is the ballad of a hero, a boy who was the child of a farmer and a healer. The people were wealthy and their village isolated. This kept them safe from war and staved off disease. So the boy grew up happy, learning to farm like his father and some of the healer's ways from his mother. He was bigger than the other children and strong, but because there was no war, he didn't understand what this meant. Then everything changed. And something came to the people that they could not stop with their wealth. There were four of them, creatures with eyes of flickering fire. The village guards had not seen fighting in many years, and the creatures opened their necks and drained them before they even recognized that death had come. Then they descended on the rest, the two men and two women with tangled locks trailing behind them and teeth like lions. They were solemn and intense, butchering and feeding like it was a bloody work to which they had to attend, taking no pleasure in it. The boy's father was with the other men, and so the boy did not see him die. His mother forced him to run. He was big, but he was a peacetime child, and he was still just a boy. So they ran, like others, mostly women and children, in all directions, blindly into the night, hoping that distance would be enough to save them. At night, they clung to each other and listened to the screams of their friends and family in the dark, screams punctuated by the horrible noises of the creatures that hunted them. The boy and his mother were desperately trying to get to the nearest village, but the isolation that had previously made them prosperous now spelled their doom. After 5 days of running, the monsters found them. It was one of the women who discovered them first, even as she shimmied up the tree with unnatural speed, like a large cat. The boy could not help but notice that she was strikingly beautiful, with her skin the color of oak and her hair trailing in the wind. Her eyes, however, were not beautiful. They were like hate-filled stars. And then there was her wicked mouth, with razor-sharp teeth that was curled up in a half-smile. But her two frightened intended victims would have described it as a snarl. The boy's mother yelled for him to run and threw herself into the arms of the woman beast. He saw the light drain from his mother's eyes before he plunged blindly into the woods. He could hear them all around him, moving in the trees above, taunting him. He knew they could kill him any time. And suddenly, he was angry. Angry at the thought of his dead father. Angry at the image of his dead mother. The songs claimed that the boy's anger was so deep that it called to something even older than the monsters that pursued him. The anger burned so bright that it caught the attention of a being living in exile deep in the bowels of the earth, and it swallowed him up. 1 minute, the boy was running through the forest with the hot breath of his soon-to-be murderers on his neck, and the next, he was falling into nothingness. It was in this nothingness that he made the first of two deals that would shape his destiny. What is a soul to an orphan, except a thing that had been too fragile to save his parents? Power. That was something that this once peacetime boy now understood and knew that he would need to get the other thing he longed for. Revenge. The songs do not provide a name for the faceless being in the flowing red robes that sealed their pact by using a gnarled claw to carve a deep gouge across the boy's face. He had blinked through the blood flowing into his eye and accepted the dark power. Then he was back in the world again, safe from those who pursued him and no longer a boy. He stumbled blindly for countless days until he heard the sound of the water. At the water, there was another tribe, and they took him in without question, knowing with one look that he had escaped something awful. The healer treated the wound on his face, even though they could not prevent the awful scar that would remain. And when he was well enough, the boy started to look for them. The faces of the four Baifo carved into his mind like the scar on his face. The first thing he killed, however, was not an Baifo, but a Kangamato, a bird-like creature that terrorized the village that had taken him in. A Kangamato carried off a woman, so he tracked it down to its cave. It was a creature reminiscent of prehistoric times, a kind of half-lizard, half-bird monstrosity that had a beak that could tear iron and talons known for ripping off heads. All he had was a sword given to him by members of the tribe, and the power that the thing in the red robes had given him, and he had his hate. He went off to face the thing that had killed hundreds over the past few years. Everybody else was afraid to go with him. This half-man, half-boy monster hunter. The bravest of them had already been taken, and those that were left were afraid, trying to etch out a life between the attacks and praying that they would die last. But he went for it, partly because he was hoping that one monster could lead him to another, partly because he wanted to repay the village for taking him in, and partly because he wanted to kill something. The songs say that the monster almost killed him, that anyone with a soul would have been consumed. In that fight, the boy felt the power he had been given, but he also felt the things he always had. He'd always been big, strong. Now he was powerful. He felt something else too, as he drove the sword into the soft belly of the Kangamata. Pleasure. In the end, he dragged the head of the beast back to the village, because he knew they had to see it to believe it, know that their adversary was dead before they could breathe again. When the boy, now a man, covered in blood and dust, dragged the monster's head into the village square, he became two things, a hero and the hunter. After that, he sought them out, the four Obaifo who destroyed his people and killed his mother. And one by one, he tracked them down, crisscrossing the continent, following stories of monsters who drank blood and destroyed entire towns. The image of their faces always as clear in his mind as that of his parents. He found one of the males first. With a deceptively boyish face, this Obaifo had lured a woman into the forest. Hunter could not save her. He was not there for that. But he did cut the head off the beast with the boyish face before it even knew he was there, hiding in the shadows with the same gleaming, innocuous sword that had killed the Kangamata. It was many years before he found another one. This time it was the beautiful woman with the wild hair and smooth skin. She had been sleeping, but he did not kill her right away. He kept her alive for weeks, partly out of sport, and partly because he did not want too many years to pass before he found the others, and he wanted her to tell him where they were. She did not break, but in the end, between the screaming and the curses, he got enough to track down the other woman. Slightly older and not as pretty, but she had noticed that her companions were disappearing, and she was ready for him. He could not take her alive. So he burned her body from a high tree and waited for months, hoping that the other one would come to him. He killed other monsters too, of course. Buddhas, other Obaifos, and even creatures that the people did not have names for. And as he did, he formed a group. Some of them were like him, robbed of something by these creatures. And others had just been born with a bloodlust that did not allow them to do anything else. And these were maybe also like him, although he had not always known it. Always, he returned to the village that had taken him in. He helped protect them from anything that would harm them. But there was one thing that not even his strength and his dark power could fully isolate them from. The raiders who traded in flesh came as often as he could kill them. They were not monsters, but greedy men seduced by foreign coin to secure bodies for their boats. And villages like his, that were close to the water, had become easy targets. He killed the raiders by the dozen, until one day a white man came to the village. Hunter had met white men before in his travels, but this one had an offer. The crown would spare this village, instruct the raiders to get their human chattel from elsewhere, if Hunter and his group would kill monsters for them. Hunter saw no problem as long as he was allowed to continue searching for the remaining Obaifo. Hunter and his group, the contingent, ensured that the monsters did not interfere with the triangle trade. And he was able to use the resources of his new employer to aid in the search for the final Obaifo. And so he made his second bargain, selling his body because he no longer had a soul. To another devil. Many years passed and Hunter could not find the Obaifo. He heard stories, though, that this one was the strongest of them, that he had muscles like boulders and locks that sat on his head like a crown. Some of the things he killed would scream the Obaifo's name at him, and he had plenty of names. The names did not concern him, but it would also scream that this one could not be killed. That he was marching to his doom. Doom did not scare him. He was more afraid that he would never find his final prey. Then the king sent word of a monster terrorizing a small island in the Caribbean. The details were unclear. Hunter suspected it was an Obaifo, but he had no reason to suspect that it was his Obaifo. That is where the song ends and the history begins. Jansen, the merchant who had only ever sold one African into bondage, a man who was transported over on the Bloody Princess, also records meeting a large African agent of the British Crown who wore a nasty scar across his face. The agent wanted information about Jansen's only slave, black male, exact age unknown, but appears to be around 30, in good physical condition, seemingly mute, but a good candidate for breeding or hard labor. Date of sale, July 7, 1702. Sales price, £5. As Jansen described the terrifying encounter to his visitor, the man laughed a hollow, spine-chilling laugh and left. This episode, I must guiltily admit, was more mythology than history, but it does explain what comes next. Hunter, whose life had always been marked by a bizarre turns of faith, had finally found the Obeifa who murdered his parents and wiped out his entire people. The last of the four, who had gone by many names and was now calling himself Kamau.